How many have gotten further in the book?
Okay, like anybody done yet, or?
Yeah.
All right. Everybody up to chapter 3, or? Okay. Why don't we just for the sake of review and a little conversation on it, look at what we did a little bit last Wednesday. There was a lot of presentation, and I think it'd be better if we spent just a little bit of time talking it over. So I'll just take 5 minutes here to review what we did. Remember this target here, this concentric structure with the primal narrative in the front. I'm at the very center. It's the pivot point, the point of reference for everything else in the Bible. The Old Testament is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt into the land which I promised to your fathers and mothers. The expanded narrative, the New Testament counterpart is Christ is Lord, Jesus is Lord, or Christ crucified, the kerygma. The expanded narrative is the narrative in which the primal narrative is embedded. It's often, its focus and the central point that gives the expanded narrative meaning is the primal narrative. And you can see it reflected over and over again. And there's oftentimes this literary device of producing a little bit of anxiety in the reader. Will it come to pass? Will the promise of land come to pass in the story of Abraham? Will the Exodus and the wandering in the wilderness ever end in coming into the land? Will Jesus overcome the powers of darkness? Then there's the derived narrative. And that usually is subsequent to the memories in the primal narrative and expanded narrative. And it's continuous. And sense is made out of the subsequent history by reflecting and looking back at to this as the center of meaning. And for the Old Testament, it was a story of the kings and the prophets and the story of Acts. And you notice in each of those stories embedded in there are references to the primal narrative. The last one around here was the other literature, the literature of institutionalization, the literature of vocation and instruction. Let's see where there was a third one.
Reflection.
Okay, mature theological reflection. What this should tell you, if this is the structure of the Bible, it might give you, just the structure alone would give you a key to the purpose. Okay? And what it illustrates is a particular perspective, which Brueggemann calls the covenantal historical. It's recognizable because in the primal narrative in each case is a covenant, God's action toward God's people, and the fact that it's a narrative, it involves a real history. This is the perspective of the Bible, and the whole purpose of its writing is not to just merely record events or memories, but to do it in order that this perspective can be shared and nurtured in the people that read it, that you become an insider. The purpose is that you come to a biblical way of thinking, that you have the biblical think-withs in your mind, and that the primal narrative, God acting toward you, is what energizes your life as it did the people who first experienced these events. The best way we modern people do that is to nurture our historical imagination. He says these words are intentional a little bit because imagination tends toward freedom and fantasy. History is rooted in events and data. But he says that the two discipline one another. Imagination keeps your memory from being just dry and encrusted. History keeps your imagination from drawing conclusions and projecting a future, an anticipating future that really isn't warranted. Okay? All right. Let's just talk about that a little bit. Um, any, any reactions to that, or now that you've been thinking about it for 48 hours?
One thing I noticed is just the girl's connection with Yoder. It seems like Rupert said the same thing. Yoder by saying Jesus is more important for our social, political, economic life. That the Bible making sense, having a biblical way of thinking, is even about the same thing.
Okay, rather than just looking at Jesus as some sort of a transaction, which this kind of transaction theology belongs over here, kind of an explanation of the atonement. What Yoder says is that Christ crucified is the center, and that that should be our the center in our way of thinking. Yeah.
And using the sword of imagination is doing good for me.
Good.
Can I say some more about that?
The very idea of the primal narrative is the central part of the Bible, and we are trying with our imagination, centering on that historical, most important historical event, and trying to understand and trying to apply that to our lives as the first hearers.
Okay. One thing that is part of this historical imagination that I really like in it, and it's still a tension, is that though the past tells us what the future will be, it also doesn't. And God's action in the future always comes as a shock and a surprise. In retrospect, you can see how it is a fulfillment. You know, God gives life, God frees, and whatever. But that doesn't mean that I've got a handle on the future. You know, I know what's coming because I know what's happened, because the pattern unfolds itself in ways that are completely unexpected. And that also means that you've got to be involved in your own history and not just the history of the Jews.
Okay.
You know, you've got to be moving into what's happening now and engaged in that seriously, and you can't just retreat to Bible studies for dealing with work, you know, pouring over in minutiae and infinite meanings of what happened way back in Exodus and forgetting about what's going on between Russia and the U.S. today. Or,
David?
Well, I was thinking, like, what's
lost
that is this perspective just allows for and even nurtures this whole. Whereas the other three things that we looked at on Wednesday, scientific, industrial, existential, just seem very dry and lifeless. And in this, there's the hope from our past and our present, and even not knowing what the future is, there's still the possibility of hope.
Okay, those two comments are related.
Yeah.
That hope is sort of realizing that there will be some sort of pattern that continues. And that is the basis for hope. But hope never really nails down its hope to unreal expectations and is always ready to be surprised. Hope is being ready to be surprised. Tom, do you?
Well, yeah, that's kind of what I was
going to
say, is that the kind of way of thinking allows us, by looking at the past and seeing the way God has acted, allows us in the present to align ourselves with what God is about in our being, in our world. And like Ruderman says, you can expect God to act in similar ways that we should in the past.
You at least know what direction to look.
Just the one problem that in that what it says here, this is a more of the same still to come, gives it this. And what he has yet to do will call into question all our allegiances to keep the world the way it is. there is more to come, and it will be as radically shattering and as radically healing as the mighty works of God. We remember what it also cautions us is that we know how God will realize, you know, that we are aligned, you know, that somehow in some deep way it won't be a surprise, you know, that we're kind of with it, and it may even be for among the faithful, especially when the God's action will promise a shock, and at first a kind of an abrasive, baffling thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On the one hand, because of the memory, we know what to expect, and we be ready for a surprise. The very opposite extreme is to be ready to be shattered.
Yeah, it's real easy for us to see everyone else being shattered.
But ourselves. Yeah. In this other book, Historical, the Prophetic Imagination, which you can tell is kind of derived from the prophets exercised the historical imagination well. When the prophets talked about the future, they used language that was befitting of this amazement and surprise. And he says that's one of the reasons prophets spoke in poetry. And I don't know exactly what to make of that. He said there's a particular language that works for this hope better than data and rehearsing memory. I'm just going to put up here a parallel. We've been talking a little bit about memory and future. There might be something parallel between the movement from identity to vocation. It's who you are determines what you do. And maybe there's some sort of tension in the vocation. Anybody? I'm not sure what it is.
We always think more of in terms of, you know, people ask you, well, where are you or what do you do or something. We think of what we do, like, oh, I'm a school teacher, and that's where we get our identity. But in here, it's more like, your identity comes first as being a follower of Christ, and your vocation comes out of that as living the way of the cross or living the biblical way, historically.
I find that is very difficult. I mean, when I think about my own chosen vocation and my futures, I am very far from this biblical perspective. When someone asks me, who am I? Well, I'm a carpenter. I have a BA. What's my future? Well, I'm going to have a kid and I'm going to move to 25 Mall Creek. You know, it's just 3 months of a future, you know. Yeah.
But it also, it seems that the identity exists within time, in the personal prayer, so that you never, your the identity you have is often the identity you're being called upon to give up. I mean, you know, it's not like something you get at, like a parallel, well, sometime in my 20s, I find out what my identity is and my vocation, and then I spend my life living it out, and I hope I come on a Christian identity and vocation in those years of my 20s and live that out. But that the same kind of action that happens in community happens in the personal life, and God continually intrudes in your personal life to reconstruct your identity. Not in its essentials, it's always life-giving and renewing, but the particular understanding of who you are and what you are to do. I mean, the modern notions of, you know, a midlife crisis, or that your first commitment to a concrete vocation may not be your last one. Saying marry friends in terms of evoking gifts, if you begin saying, well, I have this one gift and I'll spend my whole life doing that. Well, maybe not. You know what I mean?
But what about having a vocation as just being a Christian? Is that, wouldn't that be more your identity though? I mean, your identity is I'm a child of God. But I've read the books.
Yeah, but see, in historical imagination, you can't just be a Christian. You've got to be a Christian carpenter. I mean, you've got to be a particular...
In history.
You've got to be in history. And you've got to exercise particular gifts. And you can't be a Christian in some transcendent or abstract way removed from who you are at a particular time and point.
It's like this identity is always a crisis, and that if one's experience of the future can be shattering, and the future that God carves out of, and the future that corresponds to memory, if it can be shattering even to the people who are insiders, one could expect that one's identity was always going to be going through a particular kind of shattering and through crisis after crisis, and maybe a continuum. Is that?
Though he does say here, I think he makes a good point at one point, that there are periods of rest. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would be dramatic. It's kind of a rhythm where you are brought home periodically, and you get to be and do whatever you are, and then you're pushed out again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that Ted and Bridget, maybe help me this with Wendell Berry when he was talking about don't say, well, as soon as I get through this stage of my life, then I can start living or then I can start doing what I should be doing. Remember we talked about that? But that this is the part that you're living out, and this is your identity at this moment. It's not something that's just to be gotten over, but something you live through it. And taken on right at that moment is who you are, a person going through a crisis or a person who doesn't know exactly what's going on, or, you know, it's just that is where you are right then.
It might be better to just remove an arrow as if there's any kind of maybe who you are as what would that?
Well, I think in just in your identity and yourself, that's something that's ongoing. And I wonder if your vocation doesn't go right alongside of that. They're like parallel. They're both changing at the same time.
Okay, Bridget.
Well, I don't really know what the connection between identity and vocation is, but I guess when I think of vocation, what comes to my mind is response. You know, the rest of it seems like it was what was there, it was the history, it was God, and whatever. But when I think of vocation, I think that's my response to what I know, or to what I was. And I don't really understand quite the relationship between identity and vocation. I know there is one. All this is good and true, but if we don't respond to it, then it's not anything. You know, all that we know about God and all that He's done, He or she is. Unless we respond, it's not worth it. Well, that's true.
Okay, all right. It seems to me that he makes makes mention of that. That memory and their subsequent or their resulting identity push you into the vocation and into a future. That it's impossible to not look to what you should do and what things will be like and not to have expectations.
Could you say that?
Well, as far as the response goes, he says right in here how it defines, the historical perspective defines human existence in terms of vocation. Not in the sense of an occupation, but in terms of being called by our covenant partner to live our lives in ways consistent with this relationship.
Okay. All right. Another way to say it, maybe your identity is a covenant partner. Your vocation is covenant, huh? Which would mean to live the way of God. Which isn't the same as your job or what you're being trained for. Yeah. I have a real difficult time conceiving of vocation as something other than a 9-to-5 or a skill or a combination of those things. I always like to kind of compartmentalize my competencies.
Could that be the word, though? I mean, vocation. When I think of it in terms of response, I don't think of it in terms of my job role, but that word vocation.
Well, I think the job must be a central part of it.
Yeah.
In some way, because that is an important part of, even if you think it's just 40 hours a week, that's one large part of your response to the world, mm-hmm. just in terms of a chunk of time and energy, even if there's more to it than that.
Yeah.
It helps me in my understanding of vocation. I'm just sort of half paying attention here, but to make it a broader thing, by thinking of what the roots of the word are, it has to do with calling.
It's the Latin for calling.
Yeah, and so in that sense, it's broader than just an occupation.
Mm-hmm. It says in one place that
it may be personal and spiritual, this vocation, but
it is also because it's historical and rooted in events, in a precise historical memory. It is also historical,
and he uses the words political and economic. And of course,
that's usually not allowed in the transcendent perspective. That says that it's outside of history. But, okay, we've got under vocation, we've got not only personal spiritual experiences that are most often connected with the Christian vocation, job, and political and economic responsibilities, because we are in history and our future somehow occurs with the events of history.
Seems like also that living consistently with your identity is a covenant part of the way you fly. And Yoder says this would imply that part of your vocation is saying no to certain things, as well as saying and choosing other things positively. I mean, there are certain times in your life where saying no is the only way to do. And that sometimes that's your response, and at the same time you say no, you say yes, because you said no to it so
long. What do you mean you say no and you say yes?
Well, I just, you know, I'm trying to make some connections to living in this day and age with the political economic part of that, and the arms race. It seems like the strongest way I can say yes to my identity as a covenant partner is to say no to the arms race. But that's the only responsible thing for me to do. How that shows up in that vocation, that would vary.
And he's in that chapter, Turn and Live, he stresses that. That if you, in order to say yes to God, you've got to say no to other things. And it's not something you can do off and on, you do it all the time. You know, by saying, it's like marrying someone. If you marry Ethel, you can't marry Emily. You know, it's
God and Caesar, Carol, and...
Uh-huh. The word that comes up again here, repentance, metanoia, that the vocation is repentance. And that means, like, the struggle with the identity, with things always asking for you to give allegiance to that, as you know, to define yourself in ways other than from the historical covenantal position. And you constantly say no to that, and you say yes to having God's action in history at the center. And it produces the same sort of struggle, repentance in your vocation, in all those areas.
Well, just try this out, because we're talking about perpetual crisis and openness and being shattered, you know, the future coming in and metanoia change. There is a perversion of that in the American culture,
that one is supposed to live out as a Christian here, and that is where you're incapable of living in the present because you're always hungering after this future. And whatever you are now, you're dissatisfied with, no matter what that is, because you could be more, or there's some vague sense that there's fulfillment, you know, that you don't have now. California, well, but one associates this with all kinds of cults, you know, on the West Coast, you know, transcendental, you know, human potential realization and whatever. And that danger of not accepting the present, of not accepting what God's already given, what's here now. There's one point on 59 where he says, in the book A Place for You, Paul Tournier writes that the task of material living consists of two things. A, finding a safe place for yourself. B, leaving that safe place in a new adventure. Of course, that means one is never safe for long, but always between places. And so I think there are times when you're not always having to say every day of your life, how can I be different? How can I change? Am I doing the right thing? But you kind of, you be what you are, you do what you do, and somehow you're open to change, and crises come, and you don't reject them when they come, but you don't nurture perpetual crisis in your life on a daily basis. And I think there are Americans, at least nowadays, who do that.
Nurture perpetual crisis.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe that means that... what was that? Maybe it means at some points the realization and attention to the identity, you know, that God has claimed you takes precedent over searching out the vocation. Yeah. Jacques Ellul's book, Hope in Time of, or Prayer in Modern Hope in Time of Abandonment, uses two words that kind of correspond here. That in a position where you're sure of your identity and the experience of God and God's presence is near, you live in an era of faith. And that, the kind of earmarkings of that are concern about doctrine, right formulation, worship, you know, living in the present reality. The other is living in the experience of God that's far, or in a time of abandonment. And the proper posture for that is hope, that it's a yearning for the future. And he makes the case, as he, in his pessimistic way, that as a nation, as a people, modern people, we live in this particular time when the experience of God is far from us. And the position of the posture of hope, much like Judaism lives in hope, waiting for the Messiah, you know, is maybe one that fits our situation better. So personally and corporately, I suppose there is this movement between a position of knowing and a position of yearning. And okay, should we talk about, can I give a little review of the upcoming chapters? And then maybe what we can do for part of this hour and the next one is maybe exercise our historical imagination. We did this the first session. What we did was take a particular image that occurs all the way through the narratives, you know, look at them, consider them, and then apply that imagination, historical imagination, to our own situation and identify institutions, our own experiences, things that somehow correspond and try to work out a pattern. Does that sound like, you know, we'd end up doing a lot of kind of free association things and thinking out loud, kind of the early stages of theological reflection. Okay.
Let me just
the next three or four chapters talk about, well, seem to be kind of based on those four ideas, four characteristics of the historical covenantal perspective: identity, vocation, memory, and future.
Chapter 4, God the center. And he says that that's one of the oddest things about this particular perspective, was that God's activity is always at the center of the perspective. And what he's talking about in this chapter is primarily the memory. And the characteristics, God chooses a people. is for them and with them, with power, and for the Israelites it was in a warring presence in many of the memories. With Jesus it was with the working of miracles and the healing. And then there was an abiding presence. At least in contrast with this. This very stark intervening, interrupting this on something that is more imminent. In the Old Testament, the most obvious expression of this is God is in the temple in Jerusalem. Because of the temple in Jerusalem, God is ever present with us. With Jesus, especially in the Gospel of Matthew uses Emmanuel, God with us, as sort of the frame, or as Brueggemann says, the envelope around which the Gospel is built. It occurs right in the beginning in the infancy narratives when Joseph has said, "You will name him Emmanuel," meaning God with us, and it's at the end, where it says, "Lo, I am with you always to the end of the age," and then right smack in the middle where Jesus says, "Where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am with them also." So there's an abiding presence in both Old and New Testament. And then, lest we forget, there is amazement that's being shattered and surprised by the future that God decides upon. Can you think of Old Testament examples when there's a lot of play in this in the story of the Exodus, when they say, "Oh, what are we going to do? You know, the Pharaoh's army is coming right down from the sea part." They get across. "Well, what are we going to do? We don't have any food." And the quail and the manna come. And manna means, "What is it?" That's what manna means. The amazement of all the, I think not too long ago we had the text of Elisha and Naaman, the general from Syria. The king of Syria sends Naaman down to the king of Israel and says, "I hear you've got somebody that can heal. Naaman, do it." King tears his garment and says, "This is an international diplomatic crisis. I can't do it. He's just going to make war on me." The amazement of Naaman when he's finally healed of his leprosy by just washing. There's countless other stories where those representatives of God bring in amazing acts. And you don't need to say much about the story of Jesus and Acts to remember that people were astonished at what Jesus did. And that's something that's something new to my thinking on this. You know, to always be ready for a surprise. Okay, that's essentially chapter 4. God the center. Any questions or thoughts? God the center, more of the same. What we know of God here can be expected in the future. This chapter seems to be primarily on the future. And it's here that the extrapolations from the memory, in the broadest terms, that Brueggemann makes are real helpful. And I'm going to line them up across here. God is the freedom giver. Primal narrative, it's coming from slaves in Egypt to freedom in your own land. In the New Testament, it's from slavery, sin, darkness, death, disease, oppression, that Jesus comes in every action in his life, turns into a freedom giver. The exile enter. Not only was Egypt seen as an exile, the patriarchs and matriarchs going down and eventually becoming captives, but when Babylon in 597-587 destroyed Israel, they again were faced with an exodus, with being out, displaced, and need to be brought home. Exile, enter the home bringer. And Brueggemann makes the point in talking when Jesus casts out demons, and the statements about the man being found in his right mind, by the neighbors, and everyone's astonished. But that idea of being brought home to your right mind is a theme that continually goes through the Gospels as well as the Old Testament. And then third, the life bringer. Out of situations of death, the God of Israel brought life. Jesus, of course, the whole gospel story is about bringing from death to life. Maybe this would be a good point to kind of brainstorm a little bit and begin to think of images from our memory and our identity from this book that's supposed to help produce this perspective in it. Images that will help us discover or think about our future and our vocation. I'm just going to write a couple up here that may start you off. Brueggemann explores the term bread when he talks about historical imagination. I think in chapter 2. You remember what he did with that? He talked about, you've traced the story of bread from the Old Testament through the New Testament, talked about manna, talked about maybe Elijah living off the one cruse of oil and a little bit of meal in the widow's house, talked about royal bread from Egypt, wilderness bread, the manna. Jesus always messing around with food and bread, feeding 5,000, 4,000. The Eucharist, the Passover, one of Brueggemann's statements is quoted a lot around here, when the historical imagination is exercised and brought to modern situation, how can we be thankful for wilderness bread when we own the bakery? It has implications for our understanding of Eucharist, of world hunger. Okay, there's one. Freedom giver, and this is the one we talked about the first section, and let our historical imagination run wild there. Pharaoh, the oppressor, and its implications for liberation in this world, in this day and age, and in past history. Israel found itself in a time when it produced its own Pharaoh and worshipped it as king, and the prophets spoke constantly against that. And that the talk of Pharaoh and that oppression was fuel for the prophets' fury, criticizing their own country. How about some others? Has your brains got going?
Slavery.
Well, maybe things that would relate to both, or maybe from your own experience. Sure.
Sexual
harassment.
Home.
Maybe that's similar. Land. Okay. That defines it even more clearly.
The way it's often used in the spirit like it, they are sinful nature, but yet it's freed up.
Yeah.
How we spiritualize it and take it out of it.
And given the historical cultural perspective, that loses the historical flavor of it. Okay, I'm going to put that in here so there's spiritual. And birth, especially the birth of a long-awaited child. I guess I'm thinking about that now. The story that occurs oftentimes in all the New Testament. Okay. Elisha story. And I don't know a whole lot about those. They stand as they're really a weird set of stories. They seem to be independent of, in a lot of ways from, well, they have their own uniqueness. And Elisha had on occasions were responsible for healing. The covenant the statute and rules, the cleanliness, the cultic rules, had things about, and important things about ritual purity and cleansing from leprosy. Maybe not as much, not as strong as some others.
Water.
Okay. Here? Maybe that goes in every single one. God announces the end of the exile, the word freedom from Egypt. And the word brings life. You said water. Okay. Would you want to put it in someplace? The exile experience is not all negative.
Yeah,
that's an interesting point. Okay. How are your historical imagination doing? Are you feeling worn out? Or? Are any of these touching you at particular points in your own experience? These are like the little components and images that go clear back to the primal narrative in both Old and New Testament. And are they? Do they cross your own experience somehow, or do they suggest ways of understanding your own experience? I think, according to what Brueggemann was saying, it ought to.
Yeah, I find that a lot where I'll relate something, particularly from the Old Testament, to something that's going on in my life, like the 40 years where all they did, they complained, you know, I see myself all
people be so stupid to build that idol, and then I'll see myself with an idol. And I just kind of picture that in my own life sometimes. That was particularly complaining about.
Okay, well, this, that may take, yeah. Okay. Okay, yeah. We've got some counterparts. God is with us and for us. It may take these forms, but in each of these, God is exercising it. Does the incarnation belong any place?
Well, that's an interesting, that may be a real interesting case, because it is through the incarnation that Jesus, well, that
the activity of God took on all those forms. And it's sort of like,
is it latent in the image of bread and water? Old Testament is that Pentecost is God's power himself that enters into us in a wilderness situation that permits survival. I don't.
Okay, that could be. What time are we getting to?
5 to 10.
Got time, I guess. If I've got any more here. Well, what I thought, maybe for the next hour, and let's talk about that a little bit, would be, And the reason I'm suggesting is because it was very animated for a whole hour last session, and we may not be that lucky this time. What we did was select something here and began to work very intensively with it. What we talked about was Pharaoh, and about who was Pharaoh and where were the people and what the slavery was like in our situation and in others and in the biblical narrative. Do any there catch your fancy? Exercise our historical imagination on home and land, and I think probably saying yes to our homeland will be saying no to, at least I'll put these two up on the board then. Home and land on one side, Babylon Caesar on another, and let's run with it. Let's see where our identity and our memory take us, okay? Maybe everyone needs a cup of coffee. Let's take a break.